From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on March 17th and 18th, 1936, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It had been a hard, snowy winter, but the middle of March turned warm. On March 17th, heavy rain started to fall, and within 36 hours, snowmelt combined with the rainfall resulted in the Great St. Patrick's Day flood. At the peak in Pittsburgh, the waters ran 21 feet over flood level, burying the city. They did not recede fully for 5 days. And there was flooding in other parts of the eastern United States. Washington, D.C. saw flooding. Congress soon passed the Flood Control Acts of 1936 and 1938. A big part of that was the construction of a dam on the Allegheny River. Now, that sounds like a logical next step, if you don't consider who would be affected by the dam construction and the subsequent impact. The Kinzua Dam became one of the largest dams in the country, located in northwest Pennsylvania. But to build it, the United States government had to ignore and break treaties that dated back many decades. Construction of the dam condemned roughly 10,000 acres of the Allegheny Reservation that accounted for nearly one-third of its territory. That was land that had been recognized as part of the Seneca Nation via the Treaty of Canandaigua, signed, by the way, by George Washington. And building this dam meant the Senecas would lose a great deal of fertile farmland, families would be displaced, and of course they fought the construction, which didn't start until the 1960s. They hoped that President John F. Kennedy would fulfill his promise to be a friend and an ally, but ultimately JFK denied their request to halt dam construction. A new film called Lake of Betrayal tells the story of the Kinzua Dam in this context, and it has echoes to modern debates. The Dakota Access Pipeline is just one example. You can see the film this weekend at Ganondagan. That's on Saturday. Details coming up. But first, let me go ahead and welcome our guest. Scott Sackett is writer and producer of Lake of Betrayal. Congratulations on the film, Scott. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan, for having me today. I'm happy to be here to talk about this.
Also with us is Peter Jemison from Ganondagan, the historic site manager there. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you, Evan.
And
pleasure to be here.
Michael Leroy Oberg is a distinguished professor of history at SUNY Geneseo and an author of Native America History. He's featured in the film, one of many. Nice to have you back here, Michael. Thanks for making the
Thanks,
time.
Thanks, Evan.
I want to know from Scott, just before we kind of dive in here, how long you worked on this project and how it hit your radar to begin with. This is a story, as we were kind of talking about off air, that I think, like so many stories about dispossession, many Americans like me, until your film, don't know about this story.
In fact, for me specifically, that was the reason that I decided and wanted to do this project. I have to say that I'm a Western New Yorker, and when I first discovered the backstory to this in the 1990s, I was really taken aback. How is it that I didn't know about this? And so that prompted me to sort of, you know, investigate it, study it more. And my production partner had worked on a film called Honorable Nations. It was a national PBS film, and he had heard about it. And then about 5 years ago, we got together and we said, maybe this would be a good time to tell the story to a national audience.
Just hearing from a listener who says, this is a damn near where we camp every year, but didn't know the history. So this hour is a great chance for all of us to learn something. Again, it's called Lake of Betrayal. You can see it on Saturday afternoon, 1:30 at Ganondagan. Peter Jemison, what does the audience need to know if they want to see the film?
The audience needs to know we start at 1:30 at Seneca Art and Culture Center. The program begins then. For Friends of Ganondagan, it's $5 for admission. For all others, it's $6 general admission to see the film. And I know Scott will be there. Will Caleb be there?
Caleb Abrams will be there, the associate producer, and Paul Lamont, the director.
Okay. So, you know, they'll have those people to talk with and ask questions of. And I think it's a very important film to see. I plan on being there, of course, myself, and we're really looking forward to this.
So it's a svelte hour. You've seen the film, Peter?
I have seen the film.
Yeah, what did you think?
Well, you know, the thing is that I know so many of the people in the film, knew them, I should say. Many of them have passed on. And so to see them and see them at that time period, because when I got to know them was about 10 to 15 years after that time period. In 1975, I began working for the Seneca Nation as the education director. And so I was meeting people 10 years and a little bit more after the initial, you know, things that they went through in trying to prevent the dam. So to see them, it was kind of a mix of great to see them again, you know, on film, at the same time knowing what they were going through, and it's very difficult to watch that because you know the outcome. You know, their homes are going to be burned to the ground, the land is going to be covered with water. They're going to be relocated to suburban housing tracts. It's going to cause a real split within the community. People are moved to two different resettlement locations. And but, you know, what struck me, Evan, just in my memories was, I guess, the lack of bitterness that I encountered when I was there 10 years after the fact, that people had gone back to living and working and doing whatever they had to do to, you know, to survive. And, you know, I never heard these expressions of anger and bitterness, at least to me. Now, you know, they may have voiced them at home and voiced them in other situations. People lamented that they had to give up their way of life, what they called their way of life, because living really in a really the beautiful part of Allegheny, the mountains with the river and fertile lands, areas where our medicine plants grew and all that sort of thing, you know, people really lamented that. And those who lived closest to our longhouse, which is our traditional way of life, you know, now that they were separated from that, they lamented that part. But it was not the bitterness that you might expect after, you know, you watched your house burn to the ground.
I want to turn to Professor Oberg because I want to make sure that we're setting the table correctly here historically. And you go back, and the film does this as well. You start with those 1936 floods in Pittsburgh, and Congress, you know, sees the floodwaters out their own windows, saying, well, I guess we should do something here. But let's make sure we understand exactly what we mean when we talk about breaking treaties, the Canandaigua Treaty, the agreement that should have stood. Give me the sense of the landscape at the time and where families were living and what was happening when the 1930s hits and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers makes this recommendation, and ultimately leading to the 1960s and the building of this dam.
Well, flood control was necessary in many cities. These floods were catastrophic and destructive. There were always alternatives to flooding a third of the Allegheny Reservation, and those proposals were out there. The Army Corps of Engineers never took those proposals seriously. They would have been actually less expensive and perhaps equally as effective as the Kinzua Dam. It would have involved channeling waters through existing creek systems out to Lake Erie rather than damming the Allegheny River. I think the key treaty in this whole discussion is the Treaty of Canandaigua, the 1794 treaty between the Six Nations of the Iroquois, but primarily the Senecas and the United States. And the key article in the Treaty of Canandaigua, November 11, 1794, said that the Senecas, but also the other Iroquois nations, had the right to the free use and enjoyment of their lands. That's it. The United States claimed no authority to intrude on that. Their lands were theirs until they chose to sell them.
Forever.
Yeah. There wasn't even a need for that word, right? It was
free use.
Free use and enjoyment for as long as they want to use it. And I think what you have to do, and I think taking the broader picture, right, is to look at the Kinzua and the dam. To me, as a historian, it can't be separated from what was going on with the Robert Moses Parkway, and which resulted in the flooding of a good chunk of the Tuscarora Reservation near Lewiston, Lockport, Niagara Falls, that area, the St. Lawrence Seaway, which flooded Akwesasne lands, and to some extent, you know, this sort of corporate industrial pollution that fouled Onondaga Lake, which we're still dealing with after a century of toxic stew. And I think one of the constants, when I tell my students, one of the constants in New York state history is the state of New York, right? The state of New York couldn't have become the Empire State without a systematic program of Indian dispossession. And from the treaty period up to the present, what you see is the state casting covetous glances two reservations, looking to skim the cream of any prosperity that takes place there, whether it was the land in the 18th, 17th, and 18th century, whether it was oil in parts of Seneca country in the second half of the 19th century. You know, even looking at the tribe's economic enterprises today, gaming at Seneca and Oneida, cigarette sales throughout Indian country, the state is always looking at a way to pry whatever prosperity comes to the lands of Haudenosaunee people. It's just a constant.
And so when you talk about alternatives, the film explores what I don't want to say competing engineers or competing experts were saying, but clearly the U.S. government seemed sort of hell-bent on doing this one way or another. It didn't get started, though, until 1960, and there are various points, if you don't know the history, that you thought, well, maybe the Seneca Nation would have a chance here. Maybe the JFK would end up being sort of the ally that he promised to be. Or maybe there would be a compelling public case to be made. There's a very, to me, one of the saddest moments of what is a sad film was the clip from To Tell the Truth, the game show, that just listening to the audience reaction of seeing someone in a headdress, people laughing. I mean, like what we've done to culture, that's probably a whole other discussion. But Peter, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that because at that time period, we felt, Seneca's felt and others felt, that unless you wore that plain style full headdress, people wouldn't accept the idea that you're an Indian. You had to look Indian,
sure,
in other words.
But why are people laughing?
Well, they're laughing because they're uncomfortable and they don't really know how to deal with the fact that Indians are here in the present, we're there in the present, and this was not part of a film, a Western. This was them trying to bring a point across. It's a shame that Cornelius Seneca had to go on a game show to get those few minutes at the end to explain or have the host explain that he was there to bring to their attention the possibility of the flooding of the land, you know, by this Kinzua Dam. And so, you know, this is the kind of theater that we would have to construct in order to have our point get across to, whether it's a congressman or whether it's on a TV show or whatever it may be. And you know, this is, unfortunately, this is just the level of ignorance that we're talking about, is that the average person on the street knows nothing about this. And trying to educate them and trying to figure out how do you get the broader message out at a time period when certainly media was not available, not anywhere near what today it might be available.
Yeah, it's a great point. Go ahead, Scott.
You know, there's actually an interesting connection between what Professor Oberg has just said and what Pete has said. And you picked up exactly on the reason we used that clip from To Tell the Truth. There's a little bit more to it, but that's one of the things that really struck us when we found that that clip, is it got to the American psyche at that time. Native Americans were quaint. They were funny. I mean, there was borderline racism, even if it wasn't hateful racism. But the connection there, I think, is it goes to education. And I find it astounding that even in our public schools in New York State, what we don't teach about Native American history, how many students go through and they know nothing about the Haudenosaunee? And so I'm happy that we have this film, and we always tell our listeners or our viewers or public television viewers that the film covers a small part of the story. But it's the opening to further conversations. There's so much more to be explored in all the themes, and this is just one of them. And today, we just did a presentation of this film on the Tuscarora Nation, and Caleb Abrams, the associate producer, was describing to us how he still gets questions about people asking him if he lives in a teepee. They just, today.
Yeah.
So it is topical. It's topical. And education's a big part of this.
And I think, you know, we don't really have to sort of downplay it. The laughter that we heard on To Tell the Truth is racism. And that's the kind of sort of casual racism, you can call it that. But that was just, it was this dismissive, quaint, isn't that cute? And Cornelius Seneca's got to go on a game show, endure that for half an hour just so he can get 30 seconds at the end of the host sharing a message that probably should have been more front and center. But that was part of these campaigns over the years leading up to the 1960s when this dam is built. And Professor Oberg, how much of a hope did they really think they had in JFK, you think?
I don't know. I mean, I think one of the things that's pretty clear if you look at the politics of the 40s, 50s, 60s, even up to today, is that although we have a badly divided political system with deep gaps between Republicans and Democrats on most issues, historically, the differences between the two parties when it comes to Indian affairs are not that great. Both parties are dedicated to essentially getting Indian land and the resources that are upon that. In fact, in my classes, if I tell students, if you don't know the answer to any question I ask, just say land, because that's probably
that's the
answer.
Yeah.
And there would have been no reason really to anticipate much different from President Kennedy.
Despite his promises during a campaign, despite his rhetoric.
He's not the first president.
Boy, is he not ever.
To break campaign promises. You know, and I wanted to follow with Scott and Peter's point, right? It's with the education in New York. I mean, one of the things that stunned me when I first saw the film, Scott, it was where this footage came from. That was one of the first questions I asked Scott, is where a lot of the stock footage of burning houses. And that was Seneca footage. The Senecas filmed this. And, and had the Senecas not preserved this, I imagine your film would have been impossible in a lot of ways to do this. And we have kids in fourth grade make longhouses in our schools. Kids in high school learn about Cherokee removal. Cherokees in Georgia. They don't learn about anything in New York. We don't talk about this in a state. And you can say, well, it's ignorance, or is it willful? Do we not talk about the processes of dispossession and expropriation that allowed New York State to benefit from taking Indian land?
Peter?
I wanted to say that I got an extraordinary phone call this morning from Dr. Hazel Dean. Dr. Hazel Dean is a Seneca faith keeper, but she's also a linguist, with a degree in linguistics. She was in one of the airplanes that was flying over our homelands and doing the footage that is used in the film. And she was in the room during negotiations about compensation for land that was going to be taken and for buildings that were going to be burned down, including our longhouse. I mentioned the longhouse. Well, the longhouse was literally burned to the ground. And that meant we had to move the fire to a new location basically a new longhouse had to be built to take care of our ceremonial way of life. And, she was there. And she was encouraged by the elders of that time period. We're now going back toward the end of the 60s, the beginning of the 70s, to go and get an education and to preserve our language. That was because she became, a doctor of linguistics, but it's in Seneca language and she had her own theories about that. And she really had a terrible uphill climb to prove her points at the University of Arizona at Tucson. But she said to me, and she repeated it a couple of different times, I did this because the older people instructed me to go and do this. And today, she's working with one of our contemporary linguists who's working, he's been working at Rochester Institute of Technology. Now he has the opportunity to work with her. His name is Robbie Jimerson. But we really have kind of finally, Scott, or Evan, excuse me, we have a kind of, our language is coming back. Our language is being preserved. We have many more people, young people, learning our language and speaking our language. And that's an encouraging sign. But it was because of someone like Hazel Dean, through all of that was going on, we were trying to maintain our cultural identity.
Go ahead, Scott.
The backstory here, if I could, Evan, one of the other discoveries for me, for Paul, in producing this film was the fact that the national policy in the United States was to terminate Native Americans. Now, not to kill them, as Mike Oberg says in the film. And so the whole backstory is we are going to get rid of Native Americans as a recognized people. Get rid of eliminate their sovereignty. Ultimately, they would lose their language, they would lose their culture, and they would just sort of blend in to the United States. And this was the plan. More than 100 tribes were legally terminated, and the Senecas were fighting that. I mean, that's kind of what the impetus behind, well, let's put it on Seneca land, because after all, they're going to be terminated by 1967. They're not going to exist as a legal entity. They're going to eventually disperse. They're not going to have a culture. So I think that that's part of what makes this a national story, is that in the United States, in the 40s, the 50s, and 60s, our government policy was to terminate Native Americans.
You want to add to that, Peter?
Yeah, and that always comes up. You know, I went out and got an education, and I want to get back to that point in a minute. And when I came home to work for the nation, that was always a topic of conversation, you know, is that that bill of termination still sits there, sits in the Congress. It could be brought out at any time. They could try to terminate us tomorrow. They could, you know, any time in the future. And so you know, we have to be very cautious about the things that we allow to happen. Because if we show that we can give an inch and they'll take a mile, we're going to be terminated, you know. And if our leaders are not, you know, with their eyes wide open and listening to everything that's going on when they're in conversations, are they going to do something that is going to bring about an effort to terminate us? This was a constant conversation throughout the 1970s.
Michael?
It was also, just to add to that, right, just a couple of years before that, the end of the 1940s, Congress passed what we call the spite bills, right, where New York State Congress allowed New York State to extend its criminal and civil jurisdiction over Indian reservations in New York State. This was prior to the beginning of the termination policy in 1953, when it was sort of proclaimed by the Eisenhower administration. So these fears of termination, which essentially would have involved the government transforming Indians from being native nations recognized in the American constitutional system to just minorities like any other ethnic group. That's how its proponents described it. There were genuine black and white fears for why that could happen based on the behavior of New York's congressional delegation, the nature of state politics in New York State as well.
And can I just ask, because what we're talking about in this particular part of not only the film but our history is overt, not just dispossession, but elimination of culture and elimination of rights. And I guess historically it's important to ask, did it become less overt but still the same sort of goal in your mind, or did that change over time?
The termination, just to be as fair as I can to the advocates of termination, was a Republican senator from Utah named Arthur Watkins. He argued that, look, Irish Americans can still celebrate St. Patrick's Day, which is a problem with that. Or, you know, Germans can still go eat sauerkraut and stuff like that. They don't have to this is what he's saying. They don't have to lose their ethnic identity. So Native Americans, he said, could still celebrate their festivals and their ceremonies and stuff like that. But what he missed the point of is that Native American groups aren't just minorities. They are governing entities. They are polities that pre-exist the United States. And that pre-existing status of Native nations is why there are treaties with Indian tribes in the United States. That's why we have discussions of sovereignty and things like that with Native American tribes, which we don't have with other groups in the United States. That's fundamental to the entire history of the United States. So Watkins, he argued that the Termination Acts would be like the Emancipation Proclamation. In private, he whined about Indians not paying taxes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, so much of it comes back to that, you know, that somehow or other we're getting a free ride. Right. I mean, when we look at the maps that show dispossession, I mean, that's just a laughable idea. That I was showing visitors I had today that came from the Cattaraugus community, I was showing them the pattern of dispossession from the time period of our Aboriginal territory to the time period of the 1794 Canandaigua Treaty, which is guaranteeing us Western New York, everything pretty much west of the Genesee River, and, you know, all about along the border of Lake Erie and the, you know, southern border of Lake Ontario. And today we're down to, Evan, I use the term postage stamp size communities. And so when anyone is talking to me about, you know, they're losing tax money, please. You know, there, I could go on and on about the revenue.
Well, and I had an email from a listener named Martin who wanted to know, were the Senecas compensated by the U.S. government for their loss here? So again, listeners, let me just sort of reset this, and we'll answer that in a moment here. We're talking about a new film, a documentary film called Lake of Betrayal, that you can see on Saturday afternoon at 1:30 at Ganondagan. The film is about an hour long, and it's $6 for Not Yet members, $5 for Friends of Ganondagan members. If you want to go see the film, 1:30 on Saturday afternoon. And then there is a discussion among some of the creators of the film, and that includes Paul Lamont, Caleb Abrams, Scott Sackett, who is here with us in studio today. And it tells the story of the creation of the Kinzua Dam, which still stands, 55 years old, one of the largest dams in the United States. And it was built in northwest Pennsylvania. And the impetus for building it really happened in the 1936 flooding that affected Pittsburgh and Washington and eastern United States cities. But they didn't have to build it there. And in so doing that, they dispossessed and flooded native lands and broke treaties and ignored rights in doing that. How many people, by the way, Scott, Peter, how many people were affected by this? How many Seneca people?
It's hard to say. I mean, at that time period, you know, probably north of 2,500 people living in the Allegheny Territory.
I think there was 600 is sort of the number that the Seneca Nation
that
has.
Had to be moved. Had to be moved, yeah. 600 families had to be moved. And this is, you know, really the lower part of the Allegheny River on our land. The Allegheny Reservation, we might say, is bisected by the Allegheny River, running right through the middle of it. 36 miles in length there?
The dam is close to 30 miles, or the reservoir is.
Yeah. And, you know, so this put the, you know, like this beautiful part of our country underwater. One of the areas that was flooded is a place we call Genosa Degant, which is where our prophet Handsome Lake received the prophecy. We call the code of the good word, the Gaiwiyo. And that's underwater. So, you know, it'd be like, let's take Mecca and put Mecca underwater. That kind of an idea. This is where your prophet comes from, and you decide that isn't important, so we put it underwater. And many other towns that were down along that part of the river are now, you know, underwater. Not only towns that belong to the Senecas, but non-natives, too. Their towns are, as you saw the film, underwater.
Let me jump in on that, because one could say the number 600, maybe that doesn't sound like a lot, but it technically is one third of the Seneca Nation. But in one of the documentaries we found in Buffalo, the producer at the time, it was at the television station in Buffalo, astutely pointed out it was two thirds of the usable land. So, I mean, this is the best land. You can't do very much with the hilltops. And if your whole society and culture and way of living is based on the land, well, much more was taken than just a third, and it disrupted everyday life. It wasn't just moving 600 people from here over to another place. Okay, so the whole society was, and again, I'm not an anthropologist, I'm just a filmmaker, but from the stories we've heard, you know, the way people lived, the relationships they had with each other, the relationships with the land, that was completely ruined. They were basically moved into a suburb.
And it wasn't the U.S. government's land to take.
It wasn't the U.S. government's land to take. And I'll tell you what was really, go ahead, Peter, you probably have something to add directly.
I just want to say, you know, again, we talk about the Canandaigua Treaty, but what we really also need to talk about, and I've done it before, is the U.S. Constitution. If the U.S. Constitution didn't say treaties are the supreme law of the land, we would not be, you know, again, having a leg to stand on. But when the U.S. Constitution says that, and when I hear people describe themselves as strict constitutionalists, I like to ask them, well, what part of this don't you understand? What part of that statement do you not get when you say treaties are the supreme law of the land? Who were the treaties made with first? Who signed that first treaty? George Washington, ratified by the Senate in 1795. Okay, so all of this is the background to this. I want to add one quick point here, which is a total irony, if I may. I was a student at Buffalo State College during the time period when something was created called the Seneca Nation Educational Foundation. That foundation took money that came as part of the settlement. You were asking about the settlement. Took part of that money that came from the settlement and put it into educational, efforts. I was a student, and I was going to school by being an iron worker in the summer. In part, that's where I earned my money to go to school. But when the Educational Foundation was created, I got some money to go to school. One day I went to pick up my check, right? And the woman behind the counter said to me, could you wait just a minute? The bursar would like to meet you. I didn't know what a bursar was, right? So I said, yeah, okay, I waited. A guy comes out from the back and he says, I just want to shake your hand. And I looked at him and he said, you get more money than the handicapped on campus.
Oh, God.
And I was like, oh, my God. And it suddenly, you know, I'm like a junior in college, right? And all of a sudden I realize a kind of a picture comes into my mind here of what really has happened, you know, and the fact that I'm a student here, and I felt this weight, you know, like I've got to do my best because I'm getting this money. But it would take years before it all came clear to me, the origin of the money and the, you know, the significance of it, the amount of land that was lost and all of that, because that wasn't a common conversation over our dinner table either at Cattaraugus, because the flooding's taking place at Allegheny. So I grew up at Cattaraugus, so I don't hear this conversation every day, right? Until my relatives from Tonawanda come, and then we get in this conversation, then everybody gets in the car and drives down there to see what's going on.
Well, and by the way, setting aside that what the bursar said was not appropriate to begin with, to say the least, there's this question on, you know, there's a moment in the film where I think Sue John from the Black Snake Clan is talking about, do you feel lucky? You know, was the compensation enough, or was what kind of compensation was there? And I think we have a clip from the film that we can listen to as she addresses that. So let's listen.
It sounds ungrateful in a way. I think a lot of people thought, oh, gee, those Senecas are lucky. They're getting all new houses. You're like, we should be so thankful. And that's not how I felt. Not at all. It's like, I would have liked to just been left alone with what we had. But I think there's a perception on the outside that people thought we were lucky.
Let me ask the filmmaker what you wanted viewers to take away from that portion that I think, obviously she's making a very direct statement about that, but you had to at least address compensation. What do you make of that?
Well, she brings up a good point. You know, the people on the outside who were displaced as well, those living in Pennsylvania, non-Senecas, barely received enough to support their moving costs and to get new homes. So they lost a lot and they got nothing from the U.S. government. And a lot of them were really angry about that. And so it, without knowing the history, as many of them didn't, it was easy for them to say, well, they're special. They got $15 million and we got nothing. There's a lot of education that's been going on over the last few years, and we are a part of that as the filmmakers and this film. But that was what we were trying to get to. It's a poignant moment in the film where from the dominant culture, wow, you can live here in what appears to be a shack. Right. I mean, the houses on the Allegheny territory were very modest, and it was an agricultural community. A lot of people living off the land. Now you can move into a brand new house in the suburbs. There were no modern conveniences in these houses. Now you have a house with electricity and you have a house with heat. And who in the dominant culture wouldn't say, wow, that's great. But again, it goes to the disruption of the lifestyle, the breaking up of the community. And on top of that, many of these individuals then had to go get wage jobs in order to pay for electricity, to pay for heat, yeah, to pay for things that they weren't in the habit of paying for. You want to pick up on that?
Yeah, I would say that the electric cost down in that part of the community, and by the way, the dam is generating electricity, always bear that in mind, were exorbitant. I mean, they were really, really high for people that lived down there. And, you know, so you like as he said, you had these trade-offs where now all of a sudden, in order for you to maintain that home, you have to go and get another job, or you have to have it both of your people living in the house working, and the whole family eventually, you know, having to find a way to keep this house going. One guy that I knew, his name was Avery Jimerson. He would be Avery Jimerson Sr. He said, I would give anything to have back my old house. He eventually gave up his house, as he described it, this house that was like this really nice, convenient home, and moved back down to that area and built himself another home in order to go back to where he really felt most comfortable, where he originally came from. He actually went through that whole effort. And so, you know, those sentiments were there, and people, you know, thought about all these things. But it was just kind of like, what can you do? You know, you're dealing with this behemoth, which has basically made up its mind that you're going to be dispossessed. We're going to move you the way we think you should live in a suburban housing tract. And we're going to build two of them for you, and we'll decide what your compensation is.
Michael?
I've had this conversation teaching with non-Indians, and they often will say, non-Indians will say, well, at least you guys got paid, so it's okay. And that's not how things work, right? It was an after-the-fact settlement that President Johnson signed after significant agitation and protests. And you can't just take things and then say, oh, well, now we'll pay you whatever we feel fit to pay you. That's not what the treaties say. That's not how the arrangement works. It was coercive. It was extractive. And I think especially with the Army Corps, we see the Army Corps continuing to behave in that way. You mentioned Standing Rock and Dakota Access at the beginning, a body that does what it wants and then looks at the consequences afterwards.
Well, can I just ask you real briefly, and then we got to get our only break of the hour. I want to come back. I want to address a caller's concern that we don't have the other side represented on this discussion today, and that this caller might not want to listen to the show anymore because we need somebody to advocate for dispossession, I guess. But we'll address that on the other side of this break. Michael, just let me close the loop on the point you just made there. I think 50-plus years after the creation of this dam, we do see debates over whether treaties still matter. We've talked about it with Peter before. If you look at Standing Rock, et cetera. What echoes of the Kinzua Dam's construction do you see in Standing Rock and other places?
Well, what I see is, you know, Standing Rock's a complicated case because the land was north upriver from the reservation. It wasn't technically on the existing reservation boundary, although it was part of a historic reservation and threatened significantly the livelihood of the tribe. That was a pipeline that was originally going to run closer to Bismarck, North Dakota. Where there was a significant white population. They protested, kind of a NIMBY, not in my backyard protest. Army Corps of Engineer moved it right next to Standing Rock, the Standing Rock Reservation in the corner of South Dakota, North Dakota. It's, if you want to, I saw this bumper sticker once. I think it was a meeting where you were at too, Peter. I can't remember. It was something along the lines like, For Native Americans, the colonial period has never ended, right? And I think that is what we see here, right? Indian land, Indian resources are a source of exploitation and expropriation, and that continues to be the case.
Let's get that only break of the hour, and we'll come back and tell you a little bit more about the film that you can see 1:30 on Saturday afternoon at Ganondagan at the Seneca Art and Culture Center. It's at 1:30 on Saturday afternoon. The film is called Lake of Betrayal. And I got another clip as well. So as we mentioned, JFK, we'll hear what JFK had to say about this from the film. So let's get that short break and come right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, artists traveling the country, visiting different cities, learning from other artists, talking about neighborhood revitalization, reputation, image, and more. But the artists in question are from Rochester, and they're sixth grade students. We're going to talk about what they plan to create with murals in Rochester neighborhoods. Where will you see their art? What's the meaning behind it? We'll find out next hour. Welcome back to Connections. Let me grab Kay in Rochester on the phone, who's got a good question. Go ahead, Kay.
Yes, I'm really interested in this topic. I grew up in Jamestown, New York. I was there when the whole project was underway. So I wonder, I can't come to the film on Saturday. Is there some other way that we could see the film at a later date?
Kay, I'm going to put you back on hold just because the sound quality isn't great, but I want to make sure you can hear the answer. Kay's asking if you can't show up on Saturday afternoon at 1:30 at the Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan for the film, can you see it elsewhere?
Yes, we are continuing to show it at venues around the area. I think our next is in Allegheny State Park. And PBS stations such as XXI have the rights to broadcast at any time over the next 4 years.
Okay. Is there a website? Are you online?
Yeah, we have a Facebook page, at Lake of Betrayal, and we post all of the screenings and the broadcasts that we get. So hopefully I'll find out when XXI is going to broadcast that again.
Okay, thank you. And so again, Lake of Betrayal, check it out on Facebook and more information on screenings at various places. And these live screenings are really helpful too because you have, in many cases, as you do on Saturday afternoon, the people behind the film, the historians, people to give you historical context and add to that discussion. Now, speaking of, as I just mentioned, a caller earlier this hour said he was upset that we don't have the other side represented on this program today. And let me just sort of, I'll address that and I'll let our guests address that if they like. I'm sensitive to criticism as the host of this program. I make lots and lots of mistakes, and the producer, Megan Mack, and I work really hard to make sure that we're hearing voices from all different sides here. I have a hard time with voices that advocate for dispossession or really sort of vociferously defend it. But I also want to make clear here, the film, just as you heard from Professor Oberg earlier this hour, does make clear that the floods happened, that flood control had to happen in some form, and that what we're trying to do is look historically at what the choices were that were made. You know, so for example, what did JFK say? He said he was going to be an ally for Native peoples. What did he say when it came down to actually standing with them when they were asking for a delay or a halt on construction of the Kinzua Dam in the 1960s? The film has it. Let's listen.
You are, and the Democratic Party are on record in opposition to the changing of Indian treaties without the consent of the Indians. The Army engineers are about to build a huge Kinzua Dam on the upper Allegheny River, which will flood a third of a western New York Indian reservation in direct violation of a treaty that was signed by George Washington with the Seneca Indians. Have you any inclination at all to halt that project in favor of the so-called Morgan alternate project, which would not violate the treaty?
It's my recollection that this matter has been tested in the court, has it not?
Yes, it has. The Supreme Court has upheld it.
I have no plans to interfere with that action.
Well, that was that. Pretty short and sweet, Scott.
Well, it's fairly complex, but to sort of address the listener's inquiry, and these are good questions. We did talk with the Army Corps of Engineers. Obviously, this is a film produced for public broadcasting. Our intention was to tell as full a story as you can, presenting all the arguments. But I think you and Professor Oberg sort of summarized it most succinctly. Is there were alternatives, and these options were chosen. And a lot of what was driving it was termination, that the Seneca Nation was no longer going to exist. And that was the mentality in the 50s and the 60s. And that's the plain, simple answer to this inquiry. For Kennedy, it was complicated. Obviously, he needed the help of the governor of Pennsylvania to get the nomination, which he did. And so he was he had political debts, I guess you could say. He did make promises to Native Americans. He wrote to the Seneca Nation. He wrote to the president of the Seneca Nation 2 days before the dam, before ground was broken. And he did make that. He reiterated his party's platform that there would be no changes in these treaties without the consent of the Native Americans. The Supreme Court did refuse to review the decision of the other high court, and that was the Congress has the power, it has plenary power, and it can back away from these treaties. That didn't change. They just made probably an unfortunate decision to pursue this. I mean, that's what, going back to the comment earlier, what we think of Native Americans today and how we respect Native Americans and their culture. I mean, I think it was just... that's the underlying story here. If you want to pick up on that.
Well, there's I think one thing that you and Paul and Caleb do so well in the film is that you show as time went on and as the construction of the dam came closer and as the memory of the flood faded to some extent, the flood control element of the dam was a justification for what was really seen as a beneficial plan by industrialists who wanted cheap hydroelectric power to build up Pittsburgh's economy and sustain Pittsburgh's economy. And that whole commercial element and the electrical element of this story, you guys do really well, better than the published historians have done, I think, to some extent, in telling how much the flood control sort of slipped, was just used as a pretext.
Yeah. I mean, Pittsburgh benefited greatly from this. The pollution in Pittsburgh was unbearable in the 1940s. I mean, mm-hmm. You had to keep the lights on during the day. It was part of that, what do they call it, the Renaissance. Mm-hmm. And Kinzua was cheap hydropower at the expense of the Seneca Nation. A lot of businesses made money off of it. But one of the other things we wanted to do in telling this story was we certainly wanted to avoid the pitfall of, you know, the Native Americans once again lost. Okay, something extraordinary happened after Kinzua Dam, and that was the leadership of the day came together essentially and said, we're not going to let this happen again. Yeah. They took that $15 million and invested in their future, and you can look at the Seneca Nation today and point to what happened. That tragedy has helped them to become what they are today, a very strong, powerful nation with lots of people who are going to college, getting an education, coming back and using that education for the benefit of the Seneca Nation.
You agree with that, Peter?
I do agree with it. And, you know, it's been a difficult struggle, really, because, you know, matching the message that we received from our prophet and how we are to go forward in our lives and you know, things that are coming that he prophesied that you and I live with today. I mean, many, many waters that cannot be used because they're polluted and losing whole species of trees and things like this that have, you know, happened now. We've got an emerald ash borer and we've got something else going after other species. And so in the light of all of that, you know, we have still had to seek development because we have a limited space. Somehow or other, we have to be able to bring income in, and the choices have been few, and we've had to use gaming as an option. And so, you know, again, there are people who, among our people, this was a controversy for a long time. Three men lost their lives over this controversy of whether or not we should accept gaming and go in that direction. But we also had this other, you know, recognition that we're going forward in time. There are faces yet unborn. There are new people that are going to be coming. We have to remain a strong nation. We have to protect this land base. And you cannot do it as we once did it, where, you know, every once in a while our leaders get together and meet and conduct our business. Our business has to be conducted daily now. We have to be really organized, mm-hmm. and we have to be a full government, functioning government, and a sovereign entity.
All right, a couple more things that I've got to keep tight before the end of the hour. Professor Oberg, any more you want to say to the caller who thinks that this has been an unfair, one-sided discussion?
Well, we get that argument a lot, and usually it's an argument if someone just doesn't like the story that's being told. Historians and filmmakers, you know, Paul and Scott and Caleb are historians too. What we do is we read all the evidence. We look at all the evidence. We talk to as many people as we can. We look at all sides. There's not just two sides. There's all sides. We look at the sides, and some people we find persuasive, some people we don't. Some bits of evidence we find compelling, some evidence don't. All historians, all scholars, they have a question. They start with a question. Paul's film started with a question. Books I write start with a question. The exhibits on display at Ganondagan start with a question, and we present an answer. That answer is only of value to the extent that it's supported by evidence. That's what we do. So if we don't agree with whatever the caller was bothered by, and I really can't see what the other side necessarily would be here, it's not because we haven't looked at that evidence. We have, and we've rejected it. And I think we've explored pretty clearly here what we think the motivations were behind this project.
Yeah, briefly, Scott, go ahead.
Yeah, and this doesn't make the film. I don't think it was would have advanced the argument. But off camera, the Army Corps of Engineers said, you know, if this had happened 2 or 3 years later, that dam would not have been built. I mean, that said it all.
Yeah. By the way, can we do this in 20 seconds or less? Leah wants to know, can anyone there discuss the difference between what happened in the cases of this dam and what happens in other cases where the government takes land under the doctrine of eminent domain?
I know too much in 20 seconds.
I don't know if you get eminent domain over sovereign territory, do you?
Well, there was the threat of that with a similar dam in Montana, the Yellowtail Dam. The Eisenhower administration used the threat of eminent domain. But I'm running out of time. I realize the story is too long. I write about that in my book, the Native American textbook.
Good plug.
Yeah, right. Available at Amazon.
Leah, I'm going to try to follow up with you separately on that. I appreciate the question. You can see the film Saturday, 1:30 at Ganondagan. $6 if you're not yet a member at Ganondagan. $5 if you are a Friend of Ganondagan member. And Scott will be there. Paul Lamont, Caleb Abrams behind the film are going to be there. The film's about an hour long, and it's a good chance to see Lake of Betrayal. I want to close with a little music that's not show music. We're going to close with a little Johnny Cash, because 1964, Johnny Cash comes out with I Walk the Line. Now, everybody knows I Walk the Line. Everybody knows his biggest hits. But he also came out with some music about Native dispossession, including a song called As Long as the Grass Shall Grow. And we're going to close the program with this, but Scott, that entered your film as well. My understanding is radio stations blacklisted this. They told Johnny Cash, we don't want this. Give us your other stuff. And most people don't even know that he did this.
And the song is specifically about Kinzua Dam and the breaking of the treaty and everything that happened. It's beautiful.
It's amazing. So we will close with Johnny Cash, a song you weren't really allowed to hear 50 years ago, but you're going to be allowed today. Thank you, Scott, for being here. I appreciate that. Lake of Betrayal. Peter Jemison, thank you. Appreciate the time as always. And Michael Leroy Oberg, thank you, Professor. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, Johnny Cash is going to take us home here.
The Senecas are an Indian tribe of the Iroquois Nation. Down on the New York-Pennsylvania line, you'll find their reservation. After the U.S. Revolution, Corn Planter was a chief. He told the tribe these men they could trust. That was his true belief. He went down to Independence Hall, and there a treaty signed that promised peace with the USA and Indian rights combined. George Washington gave his signature, the government gave its hand. They said that now and forevermore that this was Indian land. As long as the moon shall rise, as long as the river flow, as long as the sun will shine, as long as the grass shall grow. On the Seneca Reservation, there is much sadness now. Washington's treaty has been broken, and there is no hope, no how. Across the Allegheny River, they're throwing up a dam. It will flood the Indian country, a proud day for Uncle Sam. It has broke the ancient treaty with a politician's grin. It will drown the Indian graveyards. Corn Planter, can you swim?